And so I've been most of my life a developer, writing code. I'm now a program manager, which in the way we do it in developer division in Visual Studio means in Scrum speak, I'm a product owner. But also the cool thing about the way we work is we're pretty flexible on the whole roles thing, so I do write and check in code. And most of the time they don't delete it. I think that's because, you know, I've been writing code for just a little while. But what I want to talk about here is agile development. Not going to spend very much time talking about project management. I've observed in the last number of years, and I was talking to Bob Martin about this last night, that in the agile movement, we don't spend very much time talking about developers anymore. Right? We spend a lot of time talking about burn downs and burn ups and task boards and Kanban and stories and story points and estimating. Well, estimating might be a developer activity, but you know, when you go to the Agile conference and you start to look at all the books on Agile these days, you're not really finding a whole lot about developers. And that's what I want to talk about, because I'm a little concerned that if the organizations, if the businesses, if the project management organizations, if our teams and our customers start to really embrace this idea of Agile, and I think that's happening, I'm guessing that you guys are all here, so let me just have a quick show of hands. Who's using an Agile method today at work? Look at that. So 5 years ago, when I was doing, you know, some of the other summits that we had in different conferences, you know, we get a smattering. So it was amazing to see this whole room light up. That is an amazing change. But at the same time, the developers aren't getting as much attention as they used to. And that worries me. Because if the developers aren't behaving correctly in the code they write, you cannot be agile. And so that's what I want to get to. So I want to make a statement that is a little different than what you may have read before. And I want to basically say that for the developer working in the agile world, you're on defense. And I mean defense in the manner of war, sports, chess. You are in a defensive posture from the moment you start. You can occasionally go on the offense while defending, but ultimately you're defending yourself because the requirements are changing. The requirements are offense. And you have to protect yourself from them. And we protect ourselves from them for good reason. Because we want to be able to say yes to things. We want to be able to be agile. But if there's a whole bunch of things that we have to do in order to be on defense that we just don't spend enough time thinking about and talking about. Some of these are classically well-known things, but again, they just don't get very much coverage, and a lot of people don't think about why they're important. And so they might be the first thing we cut. Tim mentioned testers, the three T's, right, that we cut. And, you know, my experience prior to coming to Microsoft is very similar to his, that we don't very often find organizations that take tests very seriously. And as he was telling that story, I was thinking that, you know, earlier he'd said we're craftsmen. I'm like, craftsmen? Kind of like artists. Kind of. Testers are art critics. Nobody likes art critics. So it kind of makes sense why we may not like to embrace art critics on our team. But, you know, I've actually been kind of known for saying over the years that I actually want a one-to-one mapping of devs to testers on my team. And I want the testers writing code, and I want the devs writing tests. But I do believe that there is a difference, and I always have, that testers, people who focus on quality assurance, people who focus on testing applications end-to-end, people who focus on putting themselves in the mind of the customer, have a very interesting and unique skill. And to be completely honest, I suck at it. I'm terrible. I'm one of those guys who happy paths an application every time, right? You give me the tool we're working on, I'm like, click, 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 that's so great, it works, ship it. And a tester comes along and behind me goes, watch this. Clickety, 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 click, slide, clickety, clickety, slide. I'm like, what is that? Yeah, but it broke. Who's going to do that ever? Right? But the fact is, there are people who are really good at that. Really good at finding those wacky ways to break your system. And you want them. So I'm going to completely agree with Tim on that one. Find those guys. Nurture that. Get those guys on your team. Also make them write code, because I do believe everybody should write code on the team. I agree with him in that one as well. Right? I mentioned that as a program manager, I'm a product owner. And as a product owner, I'm effectively the proxy customer for my team. So when Tim was talking at the very, very end there about, you know, the customer for the team is a member of the team because, you know, we're not buying an off-the-shelf house. We're building a custom house. I believe as a member of the team, I should be encouraged and delighted to be able to participate in check-in code or do design work or do testing. I'm probably not very good at any of them, but that's why I'm a product owner. So back to the developer, though, right? My developers on my team, what I try to encourage them every day is to acknowledge the difference between defense and offense. So, you know, if we think about athletics and sports, right, a football team, a soccer team, or if you think baseball is a very interesting one, because, right, there's clear turn switching. I'm on defense, you're on offense, and we take some time, and then we switch back and forth. But really, you know, that offense-defense thing is a way I'm trying to talk to my teams and to other people about the way you should align your attitudes about change. Agile is all about change. It's about embracing change, right? That was the subtitle of the first extreme programming book. And that change is good. We all know that. We know that's how we're going to delight our customers, is by being reactive and responsive. But people have, by necessity, a different attitude towards what they want out of change and what they don't. So let's look at both sides of the coin. Clicky thing. Okay. Offense. This is the product owner, the customer, the business leader, the stakeholder. And ultimately, his job is really one thing. I want Veruca Salt. I want it all, Daddy. I want a golden egg for I want a goose that lays golden eggs for Easter. Right? That's my job as a product owner, to want, to demand, to ask. I want, I want, I want, I want. And I believe that ultimately within any organization, mine or yours, when you find the guy who's the product owner and you start to look organizationally, right, so in Microsoft it's program manager, his manager is also a product owner, her manager is also a product owner, all the way up to the top, they're all product owners. And therefore they should all be wanting. They should all be aspirational. They should all be saying, we can, we will. Because this is about business. This is about asking for more. And how many of you are developers? How many of you write code every day? Excellent. And the rest of you, how many of you are offense? How many of you are offense in the room? Okay. So, you know, the offense guys should be demanding and asking, but you can't always have everything. It's nice that the general says we're going to run all the way, you know, across Europe and go over there. But no, there's a mountain range in the way. Which brings us to defense. Defense are the guys who build this stuff and test this stuff and design this stuff and pay attention to architecture and patterns and how it's going to play in the broad ecosystem of our environment. This is a defensive posture. We want to say yes. We want to go kill the bad guys. We want to ship an amazing product. But just because you want it doesn't mean I can give it to you tomorrow. Remember Tim was mentioning the ask for 3 months once instead of 1 month three times. We acknowledge already, just by the way he described that story, that we are, as engineers, going to be coming to people and saying, no, we can't. And it might be we can't buy that time. It might be we can't because of a technology decision. It might be we can't unless. But in fact, this is that defensive posture. This is about saying, no. But, and this is really the point here, we don't like the fact that we have to say no. Right? We want to be able to say yes. We want to be able to delight our customers. We'd really like to be on the side of the product owner going, hey, yeah, man, let's go. So what can we do? How can we protect ourselves so that we can say yes while still acknowledging that we are inherently on the defensive side? So we want to try to always be in a position to say yes. But that's a hard thing. Right? And by the way, this is a small room and I really like interactivity. So if anybody wants to call me out and say, no, you're wrong, or I have a question, don't wait till the end. At the end, I'm going to show some Visual Studio 11 stuff because I know some people really wanted to see that. But if you have a question on the topic I'm doing here today, I should have said this at the beginning, just raise your hand. I will call on you. I will repeat your question. Everybody can get that answered. But try to be in a position to say yes. That this is, I think, the single most important thing, and it's going to drive much of the rest. We need to do things while we're authoring code, while we're designing, while we're interacting with our customer, while we're interacting with our testers, while we're testing. We need to always be doing things that are going to put us in a position where saying yes isn't frighteningly painful. It's always going to hurt a little bit, or else, you know, there wouldn't be work to do. Yes? Yes. Yeah, so the just for repeating for the camera, right, the comment was we as developers often jump quickly to no because, and I believe you said, because the developer doesn't think that's really what the product owner wants. That's one of them. There's also the I'm lazy and don't want to. Sorry, what was that?
I'm Wally.
So yeah, and what's interesting is that is almost the proof of what I was saying before, which is we really all want to be the product owner. And I think that's healthy. It's healthy that we want to make the best thing possible and we want to critique and challenge. Well, the one that bugs me the most is when we get product owners saying no for technical reasons. We can't. Fear, scared, right? You can see that the way I'm talking about this offense-defense thing, it really is important to me that the product owner remains on offense. And if they go on defense, I get really upset because now we've got everybody on defense. And that's never going to win the football game. But, you know, there's the lazy one. And there's also the one of, I don't know how. We're not good at that technology. I've never used that before. I don't know that tool. I guess that's just a different kind of lazy, isn't it? Right, so, but in order for us to be in a position to say yes, as engineers, as developers, as testers, we have to acknowledge that, in fact, the design is ours. The implementation is mine, or ours. The product owner, and I've had plenty of arguments with people inside of Microsoft about this, so and I'm going to be telling you some stories like that, but the product owner should not ever care how it's built unless it has a direct customer impact. Okay? What patterns you use, what data structures you use, what coding standards you use, who cares? The experience that your customer pays for is what matters, and that's all the offense person should care about. So if you find a product owner playing that game, they're going on defense again. Correct them. Put them back on offense. Right? Now, it's okay for us to have those conversations. I mean, like I said, I'm a product owner, but I've got 20 years of writing code for a living. So sometimes I do go to the teams and say, all right, let me take off my product owner hat for a minute. Let's talk implementation. Right? But it's not me telling them, and it's not actually part of what I'm saying I want as a product owner. I'm just talking about it because I'm another guy. I'm a member of the team. I'm an engineer. Let's have a good conversation about it. My experiences are different than yours. But you have to always be thinking about and conscious of the design. That is the thing you own. That is the thing that is your first level of defense from changing requirements. And the customer is going to come at you and say, we want to put some new ad campaign in, or, you know, I want to completely change the UI from that UI framework to this one. I want to add a whole new module that does this or that, right? New payment system. As much as possible, you want to be able to either say yes or be able to say, yes, but it's going to cost you this much. And that is probably the single most important thing you can do, is to always be thinking about how to make your code flexible and to acknowledge that the design is yours. That flexibility is about, you know, classical patterns that we talk about all the time. You can pick up any book on good software design, on clean code, all that stuff, and they're all going to tell you, decouple, isolate, modular, interfaces. We all know this stuff. And yet pick up any body of code that you find out there in the world, and it's just polluted with garbage. You know, I've said this before. Everybody hates everybody else's code. And code you wrote more than 6 weeks ago counts as hated code too. Right? That's interesting, right? That we can't look at a piece of code and say we know that's good. Although I will tell you, historically I've looked at Ward Cunningham's code and his code's always pretty good. So flexible, and the design is yours. So if the design is yours, but you're on a team, 6, 8, 10 people, you have to have a way of establishing and communicating and understanding what kind of the big picture of the design is. I've heard people call this skeleton architecture, and that's why I put that up there. There's a whole lot of words you could use for it. But there's a couple points that I want to make about this idea of the skeleton architecture. And kind of what it's for, and a couple stories. It isn't a locked in stone, ivory tower, UML class diagram of your system. That's not what I mean here. I'm talking about big boxes. When I was in patterns and practices, I used to call it the 13 box diagram. Because if it takes more than 13 boxes, you're saying too much. 13. It's a prime number, it's fun, we're geeks. It's also kind of like the team size thing. I really think that team size, you should be able to count your team on two hands and stop there. No more. But you want this skeleton architecture, this 13-box diagram, however you want to implement it, you want it in front of the whole team always. So in the patterns and practices team rooms that we've had, and if you've been here before, you've maybe heard me or Jim or Scott or anybody else talk about it. You know, we've got those giant, beautiful glass walls that are white, and we can write on them with dry erase markers. Well, every team that I ever had in one of those team rooms, we dedicated one entire wall to our 13-box diagram. And we drew it up there in dry erase, and, you know, on day one, the first thing we did when we started the project was, well, I think it's going to be kind of like that. All right, let's go. That's good enough. Because we don't have any code yet. We barely even have our initial requirements yet. We're just getting started. Big, chunky layers. You know, views and business layers and supporting. The classic, you know, 3-4-tiered thing with the supporting stuff on the side from the Patterns and Practices Architecture Guide and all that other stuff, right? We just always start there. And then what happens is over time, and this is the important thing that I've seen teams fail on, what they do, the failing teams will, when a new story comes along, a new experience, a new requirement comes along, and they want to put something in the code, they look up there and they're like, well, where can I fit it? Right? And they try to figure out how to, like, fit it into somebody else's box. And it's often dependency driven. This is one of the most fascinating ones to me as I've watched, you know, big teams like Visual Studio operate. So you can imagine that in Visual Studio, we have some pretty big diagrams of how this thing's put together, with dependency lines that tell us how everybody depends on everybody else. And we've got all this wonderful stuff, and okay, there it is. That's Visual Studio. Well, I need to put this thing in, and I know I'm going to need that, and I'm going to need that. So is there anybody else on the diagram who already takes a dependency on those two things? I'll put it in there, even if it has nothing to do with what else is in that box. Okay, that is bad. I really can't say it any simpler than that. And that's really getting to my second point here. this diagram must not be static. This diagram is yours. This is the thing that you use to keep the entire team clear and communicating with each other about how the major pieces go together and how things depend on each other. Don't put things in the wrong box. Because every time you do that, you're polluting the definition of any one of those boxes, and pretty soon it's just a whole bunch of boxes named foo, bar, and baz with lines between them. You can't look at it and actually see anything. You can't learn anything about how your application comes. And then the longer that goes on, the harder it is to say yes, because now the customer comes to you, comes with a story, he's on offense, I want, and you go, God, I remember, there's something in there that's kind of like that, there's something. That's going to be hard, man, it's all over the place. We got to touch like 9 different things to do that. Okay, that's not his fault, right? The customer should actually be very angry at this point when you tell him, I've got to touch 9 things to do one clearly definable customer experience. A customer experience is a clean path through your environment, through your software. Why would that need to touch 9 things all over the board? It just seems crazy. What it means is you were putting things in bad places, or you weren't paying attention to when you needed to change it. And so this is probably the most important thing here, is you must be always prepared to walk up to that diagram and erase a box and draw 2 or 3 new ones and figure out how you want them to work. Now, this is terrible. That can't be there. It needs to be 2, and they need to have this dependency so we avoid the circular reference, and we'll put this here, and then name it correctly. I loved working with Ward Cunningham in Patterns and Practices because he was like a naming god. We would build something, and I wouldn't know what to call it, right? So we would make up words, just arbitrary junk words. Zabumba was one that I got from a friend of mine from South America. And we would just call it that. And we didn't know what to call it that, we'd leave it. And we'd code away for a while, because we really didn't know what it did yet either. We were really TDDing a lot, so the test will tell me what it does later. So it's a Zabumba for now, and we're building it up and working on it. And everything's going great. And it was great, because finally I could get to the point where I'm like, Ward, I need your help. I don't know what to call this. And he'd say, tell me a story. And you'd sit down, and you'd say, well, you know, it takes these, and it does that. And he'd say, no, a little higher level. So we'd get away from specific implementations of, you know, array list this and list that and the T's and other things. And we'd start talking about what it's really doing, who it's talking to, why, what it's trying to accomplish. And I remember one particular one where I did this with Ward, and at the end of it, he came back and he said, it's a referee. What do you mean it's a referee? Like in a soccer game, right? He's the guy who decides when any of the other guys have broken the rules. And when he does, he throws a flag and, you know, resets the play and gets everything started again. Whoa, that's so cool. I never thought about that. You know, we were using all of those words that you should never, ever, ever use in your code, right? Manager, context. If you ever find yourself using XXX manager or XXX context, you don't know what it is, and you may as well call it Zabumba. So we figured out that it was a referee, and it was actually a special kind of referee, so we put some prefixing words on it, and it was a blah, blah, blah referee, and suddenly it all started to make sense. You saw. You then really knew every time when the code you were writing wanted to go in the referee or wanted to go somewhere else, because you understood what he was for, right? And we put him in a box, right, that was about regulations. Okay, that was the box on the big diagram. But that box didn't exist before because we didn't know we needed it. It was just kind of, you know, business logic, right? Big box of who knows what's in here. So we kept the big box of who knows what's in here, and it took over half the diagram. But then we put some smaller ones inside, and, you know, we had regulations, and we had all these other things. And suddenly we knew where things went again. And so the trick here is always be prepared to change that diagram. Make room for the thing you want. And communicate and coordinate that with the team. There's a reason it was on the wall in my team room. Because when it came time for me to start erasing boxes, I just didn't sneak up in the dark and say, no. The whole team participates. I'd say, oh, stop, all of you, come here. This can't be here anymore. Let's move it. And you get all kinds of, those are the conversations that are great, is when you get people going, uh-uh, no, 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 no. That is super important. I've been working on that thing for the last 6 weeks with all these other things I'm doing. You can't break that in half. Yes, we can. No, we can't. That conversation is the conversation that matters. Because when you're done with it, when you're done with that argument, that fight, we all understand better what we're doing. And it might be that I got my new box or I didn't. But at the end of it, we agree. The design is clear. The whole team gets it. People aren't putting things in the wrong places and they're not naming them context. Right? That's a good thing. So, do this. Yes, sir?
I have a question. When you talk about that, you talk about people making changes. Do you have principal design principles? You talked about Robert Martin, and he's got five good design principles, like PUSCA, OCP, so on.
Yep.
Do you start with those principles, make sure that those are what you're following, so that everything, because like you said, the requirements come in, it's not requirements that change or wrong, it's my code.
So that's a great question. Let me repeat it back for the camera. Right, while we're maintaining this architecture and we've got this thing up there and we're working on it, do we also maintain a list of standard idioms or design principles or patterns that we believe strongly and that we want to always keep true? Well, I don't believe they're invariant, so I wouldn't say that I would ever wanted to always keep them true. And I know you didn't say that. I put that word in your mouth, but I wanted to make that point. That said, every team I've ever done this with, we are always very passionate about, while not being dogmatic about, pattern application. Basically, the way I always tackle this is patterns like those that you mentioned, and you know, the gang of four separation patterns and all those other things, you should always ask yourself very carefully, do I need it? And is it going to help me with this problem that I'm talking about today, which is keeping my code flexible, modular, keeping it so that I can be on the defense but still say yes? And any pattern that doesn't help me with that, right, is, for want of a better term, pattern masturbation, right? It's ultimately about doing patterns for pattern's sake. And Jim's actually given a talk on this, right, where you're doing patterns because you read the book and they're cool. Pattern, 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 pattern. Death by patterns. So, yes, but is about the best answer I can say. Generally speaking, we as a team tend to find patterns that we like and those we don't. I've only, in my entire career, found one team who actually claimed to like the visitor pattern. Most teams very quickly say, we're not going to do that. Even though it does offer clearly some separation of concerns benefits. Right? A lot of people just don't like that one, and so we decide not to use it. I've also worked on teams that disagree with the idea of introducing interfaces on all of the various parts. I happen to disagree with that one, but you know, the team didn't really like it, and so the team kind of agreed. So I do prefer that the team makes those decisions. I'm not a big fan of some arbitrary architect who's not on the team, not participating in the code, not living the life, to impose them upon me. Because ultimately, he's not in the interest of the defending of the code problem, right? He wants to get his pattern book published. All right. Please, keep raising your hands if you guys have more questions. Oh, hey, oh, I turned the thing over. Here we go. So this is a classic Agilista kind of a thing, and I have to spend a couple seconds on it because from the developer perspective, this one is extremely important, and there's a couple of key points that I want to make, and I'm not going to spend as much time on this one. You've all heard me and everybody else tell the story of, you know, are you done? Yes. Are you done, done? No. It's a funny story, and we all laugh at it, but of course we all see it every day. The point I wanted to make is, and the most important point here, is actually the very last part of the slide here. And if this thing had a laser on it, I'd point at it. My done is not your done. My wife has lupus. I don't know if any of you know what lupus is. Lupus is an autoimmune disease. And it basically means she's, you know, 35 and has the arthritic kind of symptoms of a much, much, much older person. And so she's always dealing with pain issues and all kinds of other things. And we've got it all under control and things are good. But there's an interesting phrase in that community. My pain is not your pain. And really what that's saying is this disease, because it's so weird, manifests itself differently in every person it affects. And some people are going to get joint pain in their hips, and some people are going to have pervasive muscle pain, and some people are going to have weird skin pain. And then you get the Raynaud's thing where your fingers are always cold, and all these other strange symptoms as this immune system snafu goes on. And the interesting thing is, any one particular sufferer of lupus can describe their pain and their experience and what they're dealing with, and it'll be completely different from the person next to them. Completely different. And, you know, this is just part of that disease, is how weird it is like that. My pain is not your pain. Well, in the same way, my done list is not your done list. Even the team next door, their done list is not your done list. Mitch Lacey's in the back. He'll be talking to you later. He's been writing about done lists and done criteria for a long time and has some great materials. But the thing he focuses on in his writings, and I really appreciate this, is here's some examples of some done lists that I've found in my life. But you need to go through some exercises to figure out what matters to you. What matters to you and at what level. So this, it will vary thing. I've seen teams basically do this. Well, we know that, you know, localizability and performance measurements and all the tests are passing, and you make your giant long list of all the things that we would want to see before we could ever ship a piece of software. We might call them quality gates. We might call them done criteria. We might call them non-functional requirements. I don't care what you call them. We've got all those, and those are good. So we'll do them at every single level in the system. Every check-in, every task, every story, every experience, every product. And while I kind of appreciate the sentiment there, you know, if we stay always 100% perfectly clean at all times, things will be good. The problem is, I think ultimately it's a bit of a last responsible moment problem. Everybody familiar with that phrase? Don't do anything until delaying it any longer is irresponsible. It's not the same as saying the last possible moment, which is what my wife accused me of. And so make sure that the application you do of a particular done criteria, of a particular non-functional requirement, makes sense at the level to which it's applied. I have seen some very interesting violations, I would say, of this guidance inside of Microsoft. Where, you know, we love these quality gates. We think they're so good for us. They are what let us ship stable, secure software. And so we put them in, you know, at the bottommost level of the stack, right, at the day, task, check-in, story, whatever that low level is. And suddenly we can't get anything done. Because if you think about it, we want to be able to be flexible at that low level, right? When Aaron comes up and talks to you about the project management stuff, you know, the task list that the developer works against to execute a story, and I'm going to drop into Scrum language for just a minute, that task list is actually a developer-owned thing. The developers own the task list. They decide what the specific steps are to build a story, and they decide in what order they're going to get built. The product owner just wants the story. So if you start forcing, you know, experiential and product-level quality gates at the task level, you're locking in all these strange behaviors that affect the developer's ability to be flexible within their own code base. Back to the defense. Back to the it's my code and it's my design. Think about it. If I have to put all kinds of localization code and all that other stuff in for every single check-in that I ever do, but I'm still working on this problem and I don't exactly know how it's going to be, then I'm going to be spending 20, 30, 40% of my time on a task that I'm going to probably work out later and change. Especially if you're a TDD guy and you're letting the tests tell you what the code should be. That said, there are clearly things we should do with every check-in. Unit tests are good, right? We like those. Unit tests are going to help you understand that your code does what you expect better. So keep your lists simple, focus on what they should be, and pay very close attention to what level you're talking about. Yes, sir. Well, like I said, I only have this many fingers. So I kind of think, I've always said that a properly sized agile software team is the size of a basketball team. 7, 8, 9. So 10 at the tops.
You're a product owner over a team of 7.
I'm a product owner on a team of 9.
On a team of 9, okay.
I'm one of the 9.
And
We are 5-3-1, dev, test, and me. That's how my team is. To be honest, I'd rather it was 4-4-1. I want to have an equal number of testers to devs. At Microsoft, we are very fortunate that our testers are almost always very good coders, and so we can play that role swap game pretty well when we get past some of the cultural barriers to doing that. But the agree on, right, I said that here, the team must agree. The whole team has to agree on what done is at each one of those levels, and it is flexible and subject to change. And so in our retrospectives, we will often reevaluate whether we have too many processes and burdens and gates and checks in place at any one of those levels, and we'll take it off if it's in our way. Typically, you can't really take it off. What you do is you move it up the stack, which is a way of deferring debt, right? And it is a technical debt now that you're pushing ahead of yourself. So if you push it too high, you push unit testing all the way to the release level, you're going to write code for 4 months, then write tests for 4 months. That's going to suck. So you clearly don't want to move them all just to the top. That's called lazy. But you need to find the right place for them. I saw a hand go up here. Yeah?
What about visitors like security experts and user experience experts you might bring in? How many do you usually have on an Azure team or come in for an Azure team?
So the question is about, outside visitors. Now, are you asking it from the perspective of Dunn, or are you just interested in my teams?
Talking about how many people, having about 7 people on an Azure team.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, they join the team. As far as I'm concerned, while they're here, they're on the team. We experienced that just recently, in fact. We have a subgroup within our QA test org that is responsible for looking at the entirety of the end-to-end ALM experience across all of it. And they've been doing this really cool thing where they basically, another industry, they embed a journalist, right? They embed a tester on our team. And the guy was on our team for 2 sprints. And while he was on my team, he was one of our testers. And he learned our product, and he wrote tests, and he wrote code, and he checked in code, and he came to sprint review meetings. He totally, fully participated in the team. And then he moved on to another team and did it again. And he's been continuing to work his way around all of our teams to do that. Because if he's going to truly evaluate end-to-end experiences across the entire product, he needs to understand them all. We also have people within our broader organization who are responsible for security level gates and performance level gates and usability gates and localization gates and all those things. And when those people do come in, they're either going to come in very quick, right, seagull, in which case they're never really a member of the team. They kind of come in, do a quick review, feed data, right, into the product owner and the team to make decisions to move forward. Typically what happens in our organization, though, is that they actually do own a gate that we have no control over that's up at the higher levels, right? The experience release kind of levels. And they own one of those. And what they're coming in to tell me is, you're not going to pass with the way it is now. But they need to do that evaluation first. I think of them as a member of the team, and sometimes I don't. When they're a member of the team, they're a member of the team, which means they participate in understanding what all our duns are. When they're not a member of the team, they're an advisor and they're just a consultant, and ultimately they're providing feedback to us as a team. Yes, sir?
So it's up to the team to adjust their definition of done so that they pass the gate. In the end, they have to fix whatever doesn't pass the gate.
Yes. In our organization, there are certainly gates that are provided to us from the outside. I think most organizations have something like that. And so what we do is we know about those before we start, or at least we hope we do, because there's always the ones that come at you at the last minute that you don't know about. And we try to always be paying attention to them, and we make decisions about at what level we're going to do this. Right? So we, of course, localize Visual Studio into a whole bunch of languages. So we clearly have a localization requirement, localizability, and then testing of that localization, that we can localize it, and that when you do localize it into, I don't know, a right-to-left language, it works. And every string actually got converted, except maybe the ones you didn't want to. So we decided where to put our own internal gate, the one we assigned ourselves. We basically put that at about the story experience level. Right? Small stories, we kind of maybe let those go, but when it moves up to that next one, which is a set of stories providing an experience, it's got to be done. That's where we decided to put it. Right? Ultimately, the company, the division, cares about it at the release level. So that's where they're going to get me, right, if I mess up. But what I don't want to do is have them get me, and then I've got to blow 6 weeks. We do 3 week sprints, so that's 2 full sprints, you know, cleaning up that mess. So it's about managing that debt. You know it's coming. You know it's there. You can't avoid it. And again, as the offense guy, to return back to our offense defense thing, as the guy on offense, I really don't want it. Right? I don't. I mean, I want to sell it in Japan, but it kind of annoys me if I have to take 2 sprints off of feature development in order to fix that. Right? That kind of annoys me. So that's why we slide it down here a little bit. All right. For a long time, I've been thinking about the scientific method. I'm a geek. I'm a science-minded kind of a guy. I have a tendency to think about things as experiments, things that I have to deal with at home, my children. Although my wife thinks that one's really weird. My little science experiments, I call them. And you know, if you spent any time studying the science and the philosophy of science, you know that ultimately the scientific method is actually a very simple thing. Control all the variables except the one that you want to test. Control them. Own them. Don't let them vary. Run your test. And then you get verification, not proof. A lot of people misunderstand that about science, right? Science never proves anything. Science attempts constantly to disprove. The interesting thing is, if you start to look at software development, and even though I agree with Tim that we are craftsmen and not, you know, we're not doing science here, I think we can still apply this pattern to us. And in fact, I believe that test-driven development is a clear application of the idea of the scientific method applied to code. Okay? So you need to test. We know we need to test. We know developers should always be testing their code. They should be writing unit tests. Unit tests are good. We love them. You should be writing them all the time. So how is this the scientific method? Control the experiment. Well, what does controlling the experiment mean? It means get all the variables except the one you don't care about out of play and into control. So that's going to require some things on your design. Isolation, encapsulation, modularity, the ability to decouple things. Suddenly you see why I like interfaces, because otherwise I can't, unless I start to use some crazy instrumentation mocking framework thing. Sure, there are backups, there are ways around the problem, but if I have to use that, I should start to feel really dirty about the work I'm doing. Get all those things under control. Nothing varies in this test except the 10 lines of code I'm testing. Test them and evaluate them. Now, did we prove that it's correct? No. Just like with the scientific method, we did not prove that it's correct. We verified that the experiment that we ran worked, which adds, you know, a positive note in the light of the direction of healthy. A failing test tells us either the test was bad, we had a bad experiment, we were experimenting on the wrong thing, or the system's broken. It's one of those things where a failure is clearly a failure the moment you find it, but a pass is not necessarily a guarantee of proof. So you want to always be writing more tests. Every time you find any edge case, any time you find a bug, you're writing more tests. And every one of those needs to clearly isolate. And it's good to isolate because it gives us a better design in the long run anyway. And we're very happy about that. I know you've had some TDD talking here over the conference already, and there's lots of material out there. But as you can see, I'm a little passionate about unit testing in TDD. TDD is the best bang for the buck that you can do as a developer to protect yourself from changing requirements. And it also has some wins in that, you know, you end up with tests. Right? A study was done, 8 or 9 years ago for NIST, the National Institute of Standards. And they said there's something like 100% to 1,000% ROI on aggressive automated testing. And that's just ridiculous. But we heard Tim talking about nobody wants to do it, right? So that's why I'm saying, fine, if we're in an organization where we can't have testers, write tests, darn it. Yes? What do I think? So the question is, I am a big TDD fan. What do I think about PEX? PEX is a very fascinating thing. For those of you who don't know, PEX is a Microsoft research project produced by Pelly DeHalieu and Nikolai Tillman. And basically what it does is, the best way to describe it in a single sentence is, it attempts to make your code throw. Right? It does all these wacky, crazy analytics over your code and desperately tries to make an exception happen at any and every level it can. So I don't think of it actually as a testing tool, except that what it is an exception finder. And in that way, it's really useful, especially if you have a system where you didn't TDD it. You didn't write a bunch of tests up front. But don't confuse yourself into thinking that it is a generator of characterization tests. Okay? Characterization tests are, if you have a body of code and you want to characterize how it behaves today, right? You write a few thousand tests over the course of a sprint and upset your product owner, and you do all of that in order to now confirm what it does and lock it in. Okay, those are characterization tests. It does some of that, but it is not truly a characterization test generator. Pelly and I have had a lot of conversations about this. Yes? Yes, and that's why on the previous slide I said only write the amount of code it takes to make the test pass.
So if you introduce PECs, do you think that they'll
do TDD? If you introduce PECs, will they do TDD? Well, I can certainly imagine that people who think of TDD only as a mechanism for the construction of tests might see PECs as a tool that lets them not have to. But I don't see TDD as a mechanism for the construction of tests. TDD is a design mechanism. I use that scientific method to constantly evolve what it is. Right, I create an experiment, I run it, the code evolves. I create another experiment which changes the direction of the code goes somewhere else. I'm steering that code to where I want it to be. So for me, TDD, I happen to end up with tests at the end, but that's not the point for me. The other point I want to make is that tests matter, they're part of your code base, you have to care about them, they are important to you. And they have to run quickly. So when I was on the Patterns and Practices team, when I first joined there, we had our continuous build server set up, we had all of our tests set up, we were writing and running, it was going great. And suddenly, kind of over the course of a couple of weeks, our test runs went from 6 minutes to 26 minutes. And there were a couple people who were like, yeah, I'll go get a coffee. Right? And, you know, Jim and I and Scott Densmore basically said, this is stupid. And so we spent 2 days, we didn't ask our product owner. This is our decision. It's our code. It's our design. We spent 2 days and we cleaned it all up. We got our test runs down to 5 minutes, better than we were before, with all the same tests and all the same coverage, because we cared about them, because they mattered to us, because they provide a defensive support structure for us in the presence of changes. As we make changes to the code, the tests tell us if we changed it or if we broke it. And it's back to this defense and offense thing again. The tests are the single best thing you can do to protect yourself from the offense. So run them all the time, every check-in, write them a lot. Even if you don't do TDD, I would just at least encourage you to write them in close temporal proximity to the code. Write some code, write some tests. Write some code, write some tests. Or the other way around. But don't go, you know, write code for a week, write tests for a week. Because at that point, your product owner notices and says, I didn't ask for those tests. Because I really don't want them. Yes?
You can verify the records that are returned. You can verify the records that are returned. You can verify what happens in the case of a network outage.
Yep.
How do you decide?
So the question is, how do you decide at what level to test and specific mentions of things like data access layers and external third-party components? We could do a whole hour on that. In fact, Jim covers it pretty extensively in one of his books. You got to make the right call. You look at it, you decide. For me, tests are dominantly about design and only secondarily about testing. They are about testing that I have to get verification that it does what I expected. I actually find I really don't ever like to test across the wall, right, to the outside systems. I never do. What I try to do is put one line of code there that jumps the boundary, and I test up to that one line of code, and I don't go across the line. Right, I assume SQL Server works and move on. And then if I get to the point where I can say something to SQL Server, well, that's going to work. And occasionally you get burned by it, but for the most part, from the perspective of the developer implementing code playing defense, that works. Yes? Code contracts? Code contracts are an interesting approach. What I struggle with for code contracts is that I've discovered in using them that they become a tax, right? They become, I want to be able to refactor aggressively. I want to be able to say yes to the story. And I keep running into this thing that says I'm not allowed to do that here. You know, oh, you broke some static invariant. Or no, now I've got to go change all this stuff in there, right, in order to get in. Personally, I think that unit tests are code contracts. They're just not in the code. They're outside. So if I have extremely high code coverage and if the tests are good, I end up getting code contracts out of my unit tests instead of baking that stuff down there in the code where it's getting in my way. It's a personal opinion. There are people who are very passionate and are very successful about contract-driven development. If I were doing it, I probably would write different kinds of unit tests. I would probably write higher-level integration tests because I would expect the contract to protect me from a lot of that stuff now, assuming I got the contract right. So maybe you'd have to test that. Well, I don't think. Well, the contract at a method level doesn't enforce requirements, right? Not end-user customer requirements. It enforces the requirements on the method, perhaps. Let's talk about that more after, because I think it's an interesting topic. Refactor aggressively. So just like with unit tests, I think you should choose to do that. I don't think your product owner cares because he doesn't want them. Refactoring is something you choose to do. It's about your design. You own it. Make a decision. It's not a backlog item. If you ever find yourself wanting to put on the backlog, refactor the data access layer, I hope your product owner says no. I do it all the time. The guys come to me and say, well, we really want to, you know, refactor this thing out. I'm like, no. What does that buy my customer? You guys are my customer. If my guys go blow two sprints doing that, you lose a feature. What do you think? No. Now, should they do it? Probably. Does it help them say yes in the future? If it does, then they probably should do it. If it doesn't, and it's just pattern play, right, then we got to say no again. So, again, I keep referencing Ward because he's just one of those guys who's constantly putting that on you. Ward once told me that refactoring is like sticking your hands in the code and making a space for the new thing you want to do. Right? So that's when you should be refactoring, is you want to put something in. Put it in. Yes, sir.
I agree and I disagree. I mean, I agree that the product owner doesn't really care about refactoring. You shouldn't put it on your backlog. But in the case where you have a legacy application that you can't remember all of the things that you need to refactor, you've got to put that someplace.
Do you need to refactor it? You said you have a legacy application. That means it works. It means customers are using it. Right? So the argument I would make is when I, the product owner, come to you with a new story and that new story says it's got to do this now instead of what it used to do, stick your hands in the code, make room, put the new story in. So refactor on demand.
If we do that, that means we're going to take twice as long or three times as long to get that feature finished if we don't do it aggressively beforehand.
Well, yes, so I would argue that we should always be refactoring while we're coding so that later it's easier to refactor. But when you brought up the idea of the legacy code, I'm kind of assuming we have a million lines of code of who knows what. And when I have a million lines of code of who knows what, I really do prefer to both unit test and refactor on demand. As I get to an area of code that has no unit tests, write some, then refactor to make room, then put the new thing in and make sure it's tested so the next guy who comes along in 6 weeks, even though he's going to hate my code, at least he's going to find that it's well-tested and well-designed. That area. You can't do the whole thing. It's too much, and the customer doesn't want it.
Right, but you've got to be able to put a list of that stuff someplace so developers can get to it and go, here's what you guys need to work on your downtime or whatever.
Right? See, I'm not sure, though. I mean, I understand your point, but I would argue that every bit of work like that is work that isn't adding direct customer value yet. And until it is, I don't want to do it. I want it when it adds value, and it adds value when it enables me to implement a story. So I understand your point, but I've found that you can defer that. You can delay it a bit. And you should only do it when you need to do it. I'm starting to get the wave, so let's talk about this more afterwards. So I've already said this. I care about your design. But one of the tests I often use with this with people when I'm talking about is, would you print out that code and bring it to an interview and show it to a hiring manager and say, this is an example of my work? You should always be able to say yes to that question. So pair programming is another one that I really like a lot. It's an extreme programming kind of a thing, right? And I took this chair from a company did an April Fool's joke advertising the Pair-On chair. And I just love this picture, so I had to use it. Used without permission, unfortunately. Here's the deal. Everybody pair programs. Everybody, even the guys at Microsoft, to say they hate it.
Can you define pair programming?
Two people working together at the same on the same thing at the same time on the same computer is pair programming. Everybody does it. Normally, you do it when you're in trouble. Oh crap, man! I don't know what to do. It's not, I can't find the break point, and I can't get it. Will you come help me with this? We sit together and we work on it. Okay, if it works when you're in trouble, it's kind of like the team rooms thing. Right? We used to find these teams at Microsoft who say, team rooms? God, I'm not sitting in a room with other people. And of course, as soon as the project would get in trouble in crap mode at the end, what do? You find them all in a room together. The war room. Why? Because they can be more effective. Oh! So why don't we do this all the time? Right? Now, the fact is, maybe you don't want to do pair programming all the time, and there are times you need to leave the team room, but we know it makes us better. We know unit testing makes us better. We know sitting with somebody else, you know, 8 eyes is better than 4. Oh, wait, I don't wear glasses. But you see my point, right? Get that 300 IQ brewing at the computer instead of 150, or 100, depending on what your other guys like. I was talking to Ward about this at the for drinks last night or the night before, and he was saying one of the he thinks there's two gigantic inhibitors to why people don't like to pair program, especially in America. It's either people are afraid they're going to get called out for being bad, right? That's the I don't want anybody to notice that I really don't know how to code, and then there's the other one, which is I am smarter than everybody here, and there's no way I'm going to get myself slowed down by sitting with him. Okay. A, you're not as bad as you think you are, and B, you're not as smart as you think you are, right? And in fact, it does benefit everybody. I've seen the most amazing developers in the world have insightful moments when pairing. And also, don't forget the secondary benefit of pairing, which is you're teaching that other guy. You're learning together. You're establishing a shared understanding. Also, if you don't do this one, you kind of have to do code review, right? You have to do code review. The way it works on my team is if you paired, it's already code reviewed. If you didn't, you got to do code review. You know you want to do it. Everybody wants to do it. We're just being shy. The obligatory picture of the baby, and then I'll get out of your way and show you a couple minutes of Visual Studio. Do one thing at a time. Do it really well. Then continue on and move on and write more and do the next story. It's probably the essence of Agile. Think about it. Extreme programming. All these things are basically showing you how to do things in little steps, do it very well, and move on. And that's the most important thing. Okay, so I'm running a hair long, but I did promise you guys I would show you a little bit about Visual Studio 11. And because we're not really here to pitch product at you, but I have to steal a few minutes from Jim just to do this. So that one, 5? Boss, which one did I pick? 4. 4? He gave me a computer. Did it work? Excellent. So what I want to show you is some of the things and talk a little bit about some of the things we're doing in the next version of Visual Studio, Visual Studio 11, for developers and for Agile developers. I was given the opportunity to get involved in this because I'm very passionate about developers writing code for a living. And one of the first things that I tackled is the unit testing space. You saw me, I even gave it 2 slides compared to everybody else who only got 1. Unit testing is very important to me, and some of the feedback that we've received over the years since we shipped unit testing first in Visual Studio is, first of all, that I want to use whatever framework I want to use. I want to use NUnit. I want to use XUnit.net. I'm in native code. I want to use this, that, the next thing. And, of course, if you were inside of Visual Studio, you couldn't do that. So one of the things that we've done here is basically rewritten the unit testing experience from the ground up and created a whole new window with a whole new engine behind it, and we will run unit tests from basically any engine you want. This is the developer preview from the chip from Build and is available on MSDN. And Jim Newkirk and Brad Wilson have already shipped an XUnit plugin for this that works just fine. And we're currently working with all the other frameworks as well to make sure that we get all of them in there. I don't want to be in the business of writing test frameworks. I want to be in the business of writing excellent developer experiences. And so I want people to use whatever framework they want. And in fact, they cross-mingle just nicely. I have some sample projects which have, you know, 5,000 N-unit tests, 5,000 X-unit tests, 5,000 MS-test tests, and they all just run. And it works great. We've also redesigned this experience from the ground up to be more agile and TDD-friendly, right? And the idea here is to try to get the information that you care about in front of you, and the information you don't care, you can dig for, but it shouldn't be blocking your space. So we've tried to create this experience so that it's lightweight, you can push it off to the side, you don't have to spend too much time focusing on it. So I just built my solution, and it's running discovery. I have both XUnit and NUnit here. Oh, sorry, XUnit and MS Test here. I don't have NUnit on this one. And just keep that stuff over there. So we're trying to come up with user experiences, and we're doing a lot of testing with people on the bits we've been building that let people kind of experience it the way they want to experience it. See what you care about and what you don't. Focus on what matters and what doesn't. Do you care about passing tests? You think you do, but in fact you don't. You care about failing tests. You care about not run tests. You care about skip tests, things like that. See a hand at the back. Yes, sir. So this stuff all works in Team Build. Works in Team Build, works in the command line, works in Visual Studio, and it runs the same adapters across the board. So thank you. So Jim's adapter, put it on your Team Build, you're good. XUnit, working. All right, trust me, I know your pain. I've been there, I've lived it. I wasn't going to make that mistake. Yes, sir? Yes, but... So the question was, can you mix, you know, different levels of platforms and frameworks and bitness and things like that? Yes, but we're still experimenting with the right way to solve that problem. Some people will argue that, you know, what we should do is find the best common denominator and run them all there. Some people would argue that we should spin up different process instances. Because, of course, once a CLR loads into a process space, it's there, and you can't swap it out. Right, we're talking about .NET code. So we're working on that right now in the CTP that you have today. It's going to find the best one that it can, pick it, and use it. If you have different scenarios, I want to hear about it. If you have different thoughts about how you would like to see that work, I do want to hear about it. Okay. Right. So you know, some of the interesting little things that, you know, the old Hess framework didn't do is when you double click on the test, it should go to the code. It's a developer tool. We write code for a living. Right? Clearly. I don't have any failing tests in here, but when we do have failing tests, we're going to get, you know, fully clickable hyperlinked stack traces and all that other great stuff. We're supporting data-driven tests from all the different frameworks. We're supporting categorization, searching, and grouping from all the different frameworks. Not all of that's in the CTP that you have today, or that you're available to get today, but that's all stuff that we're building and that we are going to make sure that we get right, because... Like I said, I've been doing this for a long time. I know what we've got to do and what we don't. Yes, sir?
What about code coverage?
Code coverage works with all the engines. And in fact, it's one click away. Anybody use code coverage in Visual Studio today? How many clicks? 8. Here's how many clicks it is now. 1. I'm not having it hang now, so I'm going to say yes. Yeah, no, it shouldn't hang, and if I'll, in fact, if you have a specific problem about that, I'd like you to come tell me so I can make sure that we don't hang, because I am trying to deliver a premier developer unit testing experience here, okay? I got a couple more things to show. They're really trying to throw me. Aaron, are you coming down now?
I'm waiting for you to leave.
Just come on. You got to walk down here and get the hook, man. The other one I want to show you that's interesting that we debuted at the Build conference this year is code clone analysis. I don't know if you guys have heard us talk about this before. But as Aaron's walking down, I'll show you this, and then I will get off the stage. What this is going to do is it's going to process over the code, and it's not heuristics, and it's not just text matching. It's actually language aware. We write special language plugins for it. And it's going to be looking for duplicated code, copy-paste, right? And we're smart enough in the way we're doing this. This is a project we pulled out of Microsoft Research. That you can copy a block of code from there over to here, rename the method, rename all the variables, inject 4 or 5 lines of code here or there, and we're still going to find it. Right. So you can see I'm just running over this Tailspin sample app we have here, and it's finding 26 exact matches of this little block of code right here. Exactly the same. 26 places. Opportunity for some aggressive refactoring here. The other one that's useful, and then I really will get off the stage, is select a couple lines of code. I've seen this before. Let's use that same searching engine to find it. Right-click, find matching clones. So now we're going to use that same engine to go spelunking through the code and find other places where we did that same trick. All right, so as you can see, we're trying really hard to get Visual Studio right for developers, and I hope my talk about agile development and offense defense was valuable to you. Thank you very much. Have a great rest of your day.